Culture Program of the African Sisters Media Network. We are listening to Angelique Kidjo, I've Got Dreams to Remember. I thought it'd be an appropriate song to listen to as we talk about the 50th anniversary of Mississippi Freedom Summer, and our guest is right on time. good morning, Mr. Pierre. How are you?
Good morning. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing good. I'm doing good. You are so busy. My goodness. You began the week on Monday, the 23rd of June, at the Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Freedom Summer Project at Southern University Law Center in Baton Rouge. Sounds really exciting. All those interns sort of taking on a cold case of racial injustice, bringing, you know, sort of what was overlooked to the light. That sounds really wonderful. How many interns are there?
I have 11 interns, and they will be working from two locations, one at the Southern University Law Center here in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and, of course, Southern University Law Center is one of six historically black law schools in the country. We were started in 1947, and we've been in existence for 66, now going on 67 years. And the other location is the Mississippi Center for Justice in Jackson, Mississippi, where their students, they are also going to be working and doing investigations of murders that occurred actually between a period of 1935 to 1965. Some of them are considered cold case type murders where the individuals who died, there was never anyone identified as being, I guess, the perpetrators of their death. And so the Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Project actually has been going on for several years, about 7 years at Northeastern University Law School in Boston. But the founder of that project, which is Professor Margaret Burnham, was actually a participant in Freedom Summer of 1964. So in the 50th anniversary, she wanted to do more work in Mississippi and Louisiana and bring in students who were from Mississippi and Louisiana, the very places where some of these things occurred, to look at helping them help their communities find answers to some of those questions that existed at that time. So it's an extraordinary, fabulous project that we've been able to collaborate on and will continue to work on in future years. This is just the beginning of where we're going to go.
Wow. That's really wonderful. Yeah, Dr. Burnham, she's doing some really fabulous work there at the Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Project at Northeastern University. Were you a participant in Freedom Summer?
Yes. What I've been doing is I've been working with Dave Dennis and putting together sort of the what we call the education panel. If you look at the schedule for Freedom Summer, there are different panels that are going to be going on throughout the week. And the two panels that I have worked on putting together is the one that's going to go on today at 2:15 that deals with the public education crisis, and also another panel later at about 4 o'clock that deals with higher education. And the focus on that one with respect to higher education will be historically Black colleges and university, and what are the contributions of those colleges and universities, and what are the struggles of those colleges and universities in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What I meant was, when you were younger, were you one of the people that participated in Freedom Summer?
I got you. Actually, I'm not that old. I was 5 years old with Freedom Summer. I have to tell you a little story about Freedom Summer and me. That's very connected.
Okay.
At the time, I was 5 years old, and I was sort of the first generation of children affected by the war on poverty. Mm-hmm. So the program of Head Start started around 1964, 65. I was around 5 years old, and you know, things were coming together for that. But at that point in time, I went to Mass. I'm Catholic with my brother, who I think went out to talk to this girl, and I couldn't find him. Mm-hmm. And I made the grown-up decision that because I couldn't find him, that I would walk home after Mass. And I started walking home. I had made a dollar change, which was a lot of money for a little Black kid in Louisiana. And I stopped at the store and got myself some cookies and all kinds of stuff when I was walking. And my uncle, who was working in construction, saw me riding down the road. He was kind of surprised walking down the road. And he picked me up, and he drove this big car, this, like, Buick Electra 225 is what they called it back then. He drove in this big car, and so there was a wild search for me. I mean, just like a, you know, kind of like the, what you would call what they do to the alerts when they have missing kids. Mm-hmm. And my mother was afraid. All of this was happening during the Freedom Summertime period. My mother was afraid that I had been kidnapped because kids were being kidnapped and killed.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she was afraid that I had been kidnapped and killed. And I was not. And to make the matters worse, the place that my uncle picked me up, there was a Black man sitting on a porch in a rocking chair. And when they tracked where all the places I could have gone, they went to his house, and he said, "Oh, yeah, I saw that little boy." And he got into a car, this big old car with this white man. And so, oh, my God, they were just terrified that I was dead. And when I finally got back, my uncle finally, we drove all over the place. And when I finally got home to my cousin's house, which was like across the pasture, 100 yards away from where I actually lived, because we lived out in a rural area, all my cousins were there, and they were so glad to see me. And I have no clue why they're glad to see me. So after that reunion and play, I go home, and my mother doesn't say a word to me, lets me eat, take off my good Sunday clothes, and she says, go into the room and just wait for me. And she comes in and gives me the worst whipping of my entire life.
Wow.
But she was so afraid. And she was so afraid. Mm-hmm. She was so afraid. She was so afraid. My God,
wow.
She was so afraid.
Oh, man. Wow, what a story. So
that is my freedom summer, because actually, so if you think about that time, of course, we all know about the killings of Chaney Goodman and Schwerner in 1964, but the next year, Viola Liuzzo was also killed doing voting work in 1965. So that period was a very tense period.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Where did you grow up? What city in Louisiana?
I grew up in a small farming community called Lauraville, Louisiana. It's in southwest Louisiana, south of Lafayette, and right near the Gulf Coast, there's a little island called Avery Island that produces Tabasco sauce, which is about 10, 15 minutes away. My father was a sugarcane farmer, and he grew pepper.
Oh, wow. So was it your father's land?
Yes, yeah.
Father's land, yeah.
I mean, from the time of my great-grandfather, father's land, we all grew up, all of us in those communities, where we grew up on our land, and we farmed, and we grew our own food, and we raised our own livestock, and we just lived in a different world.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm. So is this land still in your family?
Absolutely, absolutely, and I'm glad you asked that question, because some of the work that I do deals with land loss for black landowners.
Because there are so many families that were robbed of their land and run out of town, and or killed. I mean, if they didn't leave, then they were killed, or sometimes they didn't get an opportunity to leave, they were just killed. And you just look at homestead after homestead that now is, you know, in public use, or other people other people are living there. And I don't know if the statute of limitations has ended on some of this, but there are hundreds of families. And then you think about the cities, the black towns that are gone.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
Another story.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there's a whole rich history and have unresolved issues that go back way back. I mean, it's just, you know, there's so many unresolved issues that really we still, 100 years later, I mean, I look at, for example, 100 years ago, blacks owned over 2 million acres of land in this country. And now we own, 20 million acres of land, actually. And we own 1 million acres of land. There's a 90% land loss for African Americans in this country over a 100-year period.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, I just saw this film about Turkey Creek, which is, in Gulfport, and the battle there around, the African-Americans that founded that particular place. And now it's completely surrounded by the city of Gulfport, and they've been trying to take it from those families. Katrina, before the spill, and then since then, and in the work of one of the I guess, Native Sons work around, you know, sort of historic preservation as well as, you know, preserving, you know, the creek and the marshland and all of that. Wow, 20 million acres, that's a whole lot. Let me introduce you to our audience, read your bio. John K. Pierre has been on the law faculty of the Southern University Law Center since 1990 and was promoted to vice chancellor in 2006. He is a member of the Louisiana State Bar Association and the Texas Bar Association. He has previous teaching experience as a visiting and adjunct professor at California State University. Which one?
Bakersfield.
Pardon me?
Bakersfield.
Bakersfield, really? Oh,
yeah.
Wow. I've seen that when I've been on the train. Yeah. Southern Methodist University School of Law, Loyola University of Law School, Southern University College of Business, St. Leo's College, Webster University, Louisiana State University, and Baton Rouge Community College. He received a bachelor's degree in accounting from Southern University in 1980, a master's degree in tax accounting from Texas Tech University in 1982, and a Juris Doctorate degree from Southern Methodist University School of Law in 1985. You have published numerous articles on tax law, sales and contracts, real estate and commercial law, ranging from magazine features to legal journals and law review articles. You seem just perfect to work on issues of disenfranchisement, you know, around land and real estate because of your academic background and preparation. What took you into this field, law?
Well, you know, I had a high school coach who, when I played football, who just would listen to me have these discussions and debates, and he says, "You need to go to law school." I mean, that's all he would ever say to me. He said, "You need to," you know, I would debate about anything, and he said, "You need to go to law school."
Hmm.
and so when he, you know, he that stuck with me, and actually, so that's kind of what led me. It was just that simple. You know, he kept saying that to me, and eventually I did. I you know, after I got my degrees in accounting, I went to law school.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part of it, too, was there was a young man who I believe that I went to high school with, who I believe was falsely accused of rape.
Mm.
And at that time, in our community, there were no black lawyers to hear him. And I just believe that a better defense would have been raised in the 70s, I just kind of wanted to fill that void. I wanted to fill that void, and it's interesting that young man, you know, he went to prison, and I've only seen him a few times since then. But the one time that we had an emotional reunion was he was at a protest march for the GINA 6 in GINA, Louisiana.
Right.
And it was 30 years, essentially, to the time that he had gone through that problem. And I saw him, and he saw me, and, you know, we just had this big hug. And I told him then he was the inspiration for me to go to law school. I never had a chance to tell him that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's
wow.
Kind of what got me into this field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking, you know, with regards to your emotional reunion. So a lot of times when one goes to prison, you know, when you get out, you know, you have a felony conviction, and even if it was easy to get a job as a black man, when you have one of those strikes, it's even harder. Here in California, you know, we have ban the box, which means you don't have to check it. I don't know if that's the case in Louisiana. So how is your friend doing?
He's doing good. He, you know, he's been able to get work. He's doing well. He, you know, he has, you know, put himself back together again in life. I mean, he, you know, of course, you just can't know everything that he goes through, but he is doing well. He is healthy looking and strong, and the fact that he was there with, you know, everybody else at Gina Six showed me that he was committed to the struggle of making sure that there was justice for young African American men.
Mhm. Right. Yeah. So tell us about Freedom Summer 50 years ago, and sort of what was Freedom Summer, and why was it such an important move, you know, for the organizers to bring in young people from around the country to register Mississippi residents to vote, and then, you know, the creation of the what is it, that party that Fannie Lou Hamer was a delegate for.
The Mississippi Party with Fannie Lou Hamer, yeah.
Yes.
Well, you know, this was sort of an outgrowth of what had happened, actually. So we have to step back to 1963 to really get a sense of what's going on. So the summer of 1963, you have the March on Washington. So you had a number of young people that participated in the March on Washington. And even prior to that, you had a number of young people that were involved with the Freedom Rides.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to think about this as part of a progression of young people who have been organizing since 1960 and 61. Okay, and so when you look at the organizational structure of Freedom Summer, the idea for Freedom Summer really originated with CORE, the Council on Racial Equality, and James Farmer. And Bob Moses was a part of CORE.
Okay.
So you have Bob Moses, a part of CORE. You have all those young people that were leaders in the Freedom Rides, from Fisk and all those other places, you know, throughout the South. And so now they're beginning, so now they're all young college graduates who have said, we're going to change what's going on. And so they become sort of the young institutional leaders of organizations like CORE in the South, which primarily CORE had been an organization in the Northeast, and then began to do work in the South. You had the Southern Leadership Christian Foundation. Of course, you had the NAACP, all those different groups. You had the beginning of the formation of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, all these together. So essentially what happened was they all formed a coalition, and they all formed a coalition, and the two heads were Bob Moses and Dave Dennis. Bob Moses grew up in New York went to school in the Northeast. Dave Dennis grew up in Louisiana. He went to high school at a school right near our Southern University campus called Southern University Laboratory School. And they came together as young men. Bob was actually the senior, the old man of the group, at the age of about 29. He was the old man of the group, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Dave Dennis was about 23. And so they came together so that, you know, this was all part of a process of organizing people to vote, sit-ins, the Freedom Rides, all these actions taken all over the country. And so they continue to work after the March on Washington and actually started planning this actually in the fall of 1963, going forward as to do something to break, to penetrate in Mississippi. Mississippi was the place that they determined was the hardest place to penetrate. In other words, they had made progress in Alabama. So if you think about, for example, the civil rights protests in Alabama, you also had other things that were going on in 1963, which really became the catalyst. In other words, the country was about to explode. Medgar Evers got assassinated in 1963 in Jackson in the summer of 1963. There was another, Lewis Allen was another civil rights worker who was killed in Mississippi in 1963. You had the 16th Street bombing in Birmingham. Mm-hmm. In, I believe it was September of 1963. What you had was a reign of terror going on, and there was a core group of folks who just said, we have to continue. We cannot sit aside, and we're all educated. We cannot continue to get our education and see our people suffer. So they just kept working through that process to get a confederated group that would lead the campaign to get people registered to vote in Mississippi to be ready for the upcoming presidential election that was going on in 1964. And, of course, remember in 1963, later on in 1963, in November, John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Mm-hmm. So you have all of this violence. People are dying. 1963 was an extremely violent year. People are dying everywhere for the cause of civil rights, and more people are galvanized to engage in this. So they begin to strategize at Tougaloo College around December of 1963. And there were many places that would not host these young African-American leaders planned and organized this big event. But they did it at Tougaloo College, and they met, and they had the safety of Tougaloo College to plan, and they started doing work in the Midwest and some of these other, and they issued a call. They decided to issue a call for students from around the country, from other parts of the country, to join their work and other different organizations to join their work to do establish a right to vote, to establish the issue of housing. So they kind of looked at four major areas: voting, housing, economics, and education. Mm-hmm. So from that, we have people like Marion Wright Edelman, who works with a number of different folks as a young woman to develop the Freedom School. And you see this whole idea of improving housing conditions and living conditions, folks in Mississippi, to improve literacy rates, to have people in Mississippi, you know, demand jobs better than being, I guess what you would call domestics and field workers, sharecroppers, and to generate them the power to vote. To official Mississippi delegation that was an all-white delegation to protest at the National Convention. So those were the kind of overarching goals of Freedom Summer in 1964. It was actually called the Mississippi Project. The Mississippi Project, it later became known as Freedom Summer. It was never officially, at that time, Freedom Summer.
Okay.
But it became known as Freedom Summer.
Mhm. Yeah. The film, Stanley Nelson's film, Freedom Summer, aired last night on PBS. And as I was watching it again, because I previewed it, it's really moving. Like all those brave people. Oh my goodness. You know, people who have lost loved ones. You know, during the period. really passionate speech by Dave Dennis, you know, when the three men are killed, disappear and killed. Yeah, it's just like, wow, I don't know if I could have done that.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, the thing about that, from a personal perspective from Dave Dennis, mm-hmm. is that Dave was supposed to be in the car with them.
Mm-hmm.
And he was too ill to travel with them. And had he been in that car, he would have been killed too.
Yeah, it would have been four. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So you said that you the panel today is one that you curated around education. And I was wondering,
right.
In your closing minutes, if you could talk about your panel and also about the sort of, you know, coming forward with the work that was done 50 years ago. There's a whole lot happening around voting rights because each state has its own interpretation of that. And so voting rights are being affected for people of African descent throughout the nation. And I was just wondering if you maybe could give us an update on what's going on around that, as well as the education, which, you know, this panel, which you've sort of pulled together. And I remember the Freedom Schools actually happened. My daughter was participating in the Freedom Summer, Freedom School in Oakland, because they actually have, each summer, they have Freedom Schools in a variety of places here still to teach young people about their Black heritage, as
right.
well as bring them up on other areas of academic work. Like their math and their language arts, but it's all within the context of Black history, which is really nice.
Right, right. Well, when you think about sort of the outcomes from Freedom Summer and the unfinished business, and let me tell you something, when you talk to Bob Moses and Dave Dennis and all those individuals, there is an unfinished agenda that those people want to see finished, hopefully, in their lifetimes.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, one of the outcomes of Freedom Summer was the signing of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. There was so much intense publicity put on the inhumane conditions in Mississippi, which is what the workers, the students, everybody involved created was this intense focus on Mississippi that it moved the Congress, the president, and the nation to recognize the inhumane conditions that existed, and also led to the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which is the comprehensive Civil Rights Act law ever signed. It was not the first Civil Rights Act signed into law. There have been three other Civil Rights Acts signed into law in the history of the United States prior to 1964, but 1964 Civil Rights legislation is probably one of the greatest legislative pieces in the history of the United States. So everything that we look at in terms of equal pay, discrimination, against women, Title IX, all those things that come about for women. And it's not just about race. It's also about equality for women that comes out of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So that's one big piece. The second part of that was that the focus on getting blacks to vote now deals with, at that time, the poll tax and other devices, the literacy test and other devices that were used to prevent blacks from voting. And so you have the situation where, as a result of all that work, in the next year, in 1965, we have evidence gathered that becomes the basis for the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that primarily affects, if you think about the United States, primarily affects the southern states and all the states that had pernicious systems of voting discrimination against African-American citizens and other citizens, that were in the form of poll taxes, literacy tests, and other type of things like separate primaries and all kinds of really crazy gerrymandering type things, at-large elections without proportional representation. All those things now come under the purview of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. But the 1965 Voting Rights Act did not apply theoretically to all states because some states did not have those particular restrictions, although there might have been other ways to restrict blacks from voting. Those were not the devices that those states used. And so one of the big things, if we fast forward today, is that the Civil Rights Act of 1965 had to be renewed every year. It was not a permanent statute, unlike the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The Voting Rights Act had to come up for renewal because it was a remedy to eliminate vestiges of the past discriminatory voting practice. The Supreme Court, after being years of challenges to renewal of the Voting Rights Act on two different occasions, of course, last year ruled that one part of the Voting Rights Act was no longer constitutional, and that part which is preclearance. And what preclearance requires is that in certain places where there has been established, going back to 1965, discriminatory voting practices in other places, anytime there was a change in any voting system process, the city, the municipality, the state had to get that change pre-cleared through the Justice Department. Otherwise, the election could not go on or the voting practice could not be dealt with. And so what that did was it got the Justice Department involved in looking at voting practice in the state. And for a state like Louisiana or Mississippi, this is what the critical part is. You had the federal government oversight over state practice, period, which meant that state and local officials were very, very reluctant to create anything that could be deemed as illegal under Voting Rights Act. Well, the Supreme Court just ruled a year ago that that provision of the Voting Rights Act is unconstitutional. All right? Now, other provisions of the Voting Rights Act are not unconstitutional. It's just that. Now, here's the impact. What that means, for example, let's say for a guy like me here in Louisiana, Lori, I've dealt with a couple of voting rights cases, is that before, let's say, the small community, where they might have changed the lines of district, I could challenge it administratively by going to the Justice Department, asking the Justice Department to investigate, and that action could be stopped. Now, if I think that it is discriminatory and violates voting rights of certain minority groups, I have to file a lawsuit, and I actually have to prove it in court, which could take years, that this was discriminatory. And in the meantime, you could have had a couple of elections. Plus, with the change in the federal judiciary because of, you know, a lot of Republican appointments, there's no guarantee that you will find a federal judge that would agree with you. So that is the impact of that Supreme Court ruling. And so what that now requires us to do is, as a community of lawyers who are interested in this kind of work, we have to galvanize to train a whole new generation of lawyers to file those lawsuits that were filed 50 years ago and to learn the art of prosecuting those cases. Until a new Civil Rights Act might be put into place. And there are negotiations right now in terms of creating a new Civil Rights Act. So with some different provisions that existed in the 65 Civil Rights Act. So now what you see, of course, across the country is all of these ways to sort of restrict minority voters, the ID laws, the various efforts to change precincts and locations and all kinds of what I call changing of voting lines and districts and general elections instead of district by district, all those actions now, you're going to begin to see states and counties and municipalities engage in those kinds of things because they don't have to get those changes pre-cleared anymore. Mm-hmm. And so the challenge that you've got to file a lawsuit, and that can take a long time to get resolved. And in the meantime, you could have a change in political power base and all kinds of things in the meantime. So that's kind of the impact of the Civil Rights Act of 1965, I mean the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and the impact of the decision. On the education front, one of the big areas that Bob Moses particularly is pushing for is to have a constitutional amendment that at the federal level essentially promises a quality education for every kid. And most people don't realize this, but public education or education is mostly a state function. There is some federal intervention in public education, for example, Title I at the federal level and No Child Left Behind, et cetera. We see those kinds of interventions from the federal level. But essentially, public education and education policy is a state function. So we have uneven education. We have uneven funding, we have poor funding, and we also see the privatization of public education through voucher programs, some people call it charter schools, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the one thing we don't have is we do not have a system where, from a federal constitutional standpoint, every child is entitled to a quality education. You have some states that have that in their state constitution, but it's not part of the federal constitution. And one of the big things that's going to be talked about during Freedom Summer is this initiative, this ballot initiative in Mississippi to get Mississippians to vote to amend the Mississippi Constitution to provide for quality education in the state of Mississippi. If you look at the state of Mississippi, it ranks last in almost every major category related to health, education, welfare, prisons, et cetera, et cetera. And that is a huge problem. And that's one of the big outcomes that hopefully will be done, will be the result of this 50th anniversary. We can re-galvanize people. And then there's also the Youth Congress, which is also trying to build coalitions around issues related to criminal justice, Trayvon Martin killing, and all these various laws in states, the stay-in-your-ground laws and everything else, that essentially results in a situation where young black men are being killed at an alarming rate, unfortunately not by other races sometimes, but by other young black men who can use these defenses. So it's a very fascinating gathering of people who have unfinished business with trying to galvanize a new generation to understand what they did 50 years ago and charge them that this work continues. Because I think a lot of people fall asleep with the concept that we have an African-American president and we don't need to deal with a lot of issues in this country. And electing an African-American as president, while it's a great thing, will not be the elixir that will help us solve some of these huge problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Gosh. So, Mr. Pierre, the Freedom 50, Mississippi Freedom Summer 1964 to 2014, the Intergenerational Action Agenda at Tougaloo College in Jackson, Mississippi, which began on Monday and it continues through Sunday. How do people who are in the area find out sort of more information about the conference and actually attend? Because this is only Wednesday, so there are a whole lot more days there. Is it a free a gathering, a free conference?
No, actually, you have to register. There's a website that they've developed, and I don't remember the But there's a, I think it's MFS 50th is the web. There's a website. And also, here's something too. This is not the only place where there are Freedom Summer 50th activities.
Okay.
There are activities all throughout Mississippi, and there have been activities outside of Mississippi, for example. There was one activity in Chicago, one in New Orleans. So in Philadelphia, Mississippi, which is where Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman were killed, there are activities going on in Philadelphia, Mississippi, Meridian, Mississippi, in the Mississippi Delta.
Nice.
So there are a variety of activities, although this activity is the largest of all those other activities.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I was just looking at just the closing. Actually, I think Saturday you have the Legacy Banquet in recognition for Freedom Summer 50th, and you've got Danny Glover as Master of Ceremonies, Julian Bond, Statement of the Occasion, Dick Gregory keynote, and Ayanna Gregory presentation. Who is Ayanna Gregory?
Ayanna is Dick's daughter.
Oh, okay. Oh,
yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, never get a chance to hear from his daughter. Oh, that's going to be excellent. Oh, wow. Are you all videotaping these various sessions? Is it going to be available?
There are going to be videotapes of various sessions. I know that's being coordinated because I know that's being coordinated. And depending on where the venue is, they've got some retrofitted venues where that's being done. But, yes, that is being done.
Mm-hmm. Super, super. And then on Saturday, June 28th, you mentioned sort of inspiring, you know, the current generation to take this forward. You've got this workshop entitled Freedom Summer Continues, Boots on the Ground. And it's a call to participate in various Freedom Summer 2014 actions, including youth-led projects in Mississippi, Florida, Ohio, North Carolina, and other areas across the United States. So that's excellent. Is anything happening in California? Because I know some people came from California for Freedom Summer.
I don't know if there are any organized efforts in relation to that in California, but I think appreciated. These were organized efforts that were created by a cohort of students, and I think they want to expand it in the other states. So these are just the places where there were activities already going on that were brought into Freedom Summer. In other words, this was a completely separate group who now they started essentially collaborating with some of the organizers of Freedom Summer. And it really, again, a lot of that was created by the Trayvon Martin situation.
Okay.
A lot of folks are saying, so you think about this, every so many years there's an event that galvanizes a group from a different decade. Several years ago, when my son was in college at Southern University, it was the Gene of Six. You know, it galvanized a whole different group of kids who were born in the 80s, right? the last couple of years has been Trayvon Martin, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's been the kind of the group that were born in the 90s, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And if you think back, say, another decade before then, we got the Rodney King situation.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
You know, who that galvanized folks from the 70s. You know what I mean? Who were born in the 70s.
Mm-hmm, yes. Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So,
right.
You know, because if you think about it, those, I use that time, 1970, I use kind of as a dividing line. 1970, quote, a lot of people thought we were free, and so we didn't have the same kind of urgency. So you have a whole generation of young African-American children born at 1970 or later who have no clue about the 40s, 50s, 60s. They just don't. And I suspect that's the case in Oakland, California, with respect to the Black Panther Party. I mean, they've heard about it, but they have no real clue about it.
Mm.
It's something in a book.
Yeah,
it's something in a book. You know, it's something
yeah.
in a book. They read about it. They just weren't there.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. But then, you know, what happened with Oscar Grant is also, you know, something that has galvanized a lot of young people, you know, to,
yes.
to look at, you know, law enforcement and human
yes.
rights.
That happened
yes.
at the, is that the BART station in Oakland?
Yes.
Is
mm-hmm.
that the, yeah, right, exactly. And so, and so you have these events that happen nationally and also from a regional standpoint. That galvanized folks, and so what the organizers of Mississippi Freedom Summer 50 is attempting to do is to bring all those young, energetic folks together with the elders who organize, who say, this is how you organize, this is how you advocate. So it's a marriage between the young millennials, I'll use that term broadly, you know, the X and Y and millennial generations who now, so think about this. They got the word out on Mississippi Freedom Summer by pen and paper, right?
Right.
Exactly. There were no fax machines in 1964. There was no email in 1964, right? There
right.
wasn't Twitter. There wasn't Facebook, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine if all those tools were available back then, what would have happened? Just think about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The massive outflowing?
Yeah, that would have been big.
Oh, and it was, and it was big then. It would have been unbelievable, right?
Oh, yeah, because
so
Johnson. I was just thinking about how Johnson, he's shown in the film how worried he was. He had to go to bed and for 3 days and get his nerves together because he just couldn't take what was going on with these black folks rising up.
Yeah, exactly. He couldn't take it. And Bob Moses was writing letters to the president. And, I mean, he was just straight up. I mean, you should read some of those letters that Bob Moses wrote to Lyndon B. Johnson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It just, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. Where are they published?
They're actually in an archive. The University of Wisconsin has an archive of documents
mm-hmm.
and a special collection of Mississippi Freedom Summer 50.
Okay.
Yeah, there's one place where they are. So if you Google it, you'll see this archive.
Okay.
Where you
okay.
can get documents, actual documents, pamphlets, that were used by the Freedom School educators and all kinds of things.
Okay, great. Yeah, definitely do that. Hopefully it's digitized, which means we could look at it online. That'd be great.
You can. You sure can. You can. It is a digital collection, yes. Yes.
Oh, wonderful. Definitely I'm going to check that
yeah.
out. Thank you. Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a really wonderful conversation. You said you couldn't do an hour, and look here, we've been talking
well,
for an
here.
Hour.
Once we got to talking, what was time, right?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
we have a wonderful technology. I've been moving around the city, hands-free, talking to you. Nobody knows what's going on, and we love it. The beauty of the technology, right?
Certainly. So, next week, you know, we're entering into this country's acknowledgement of its independence. And,
right.
you know, Frederick Douglass had a lot to say about that. And it's kind of interesting that, and I know it's purposeful that the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Summer is staged right before Independence Day, and I was wondering if you could maybe reflect on that as, you know, we end our conversation.
Well, it's in addition to that, it also is staged right after Juneteenth.
Yes.
In
okay.
between Juneteenth and the 4th of July, July 19th and the 4th of July. So what, to me, what it symbolizes is that this week shows us how you know, starting with June 19th as the day that African American or Africans, the slaves in Galveston, learning the freedom, and that is widely recognized as the day when all black folks were declared free. Although technically that is not true, but in a sense that there were African slaves in the Indian tribes at various places that were not declared free after the Civil War until 2 or 3 years later. That's a little known history fact. But essentially that is the day we recognize for African Americans as our day of freedom, as well as, you know, the 4th of July recognized as Independence Day. And what's so interesting about that is, of course, Africans were declared to be three-fifths. Slaves were declared to be three-fifths of a human being, 60%, for electoral purposes and all number of purposes. But the literal meaning of that three-fifths of a person meant that we were less than human. And to borrow from the president of Southern University System, we have to work on the five-fifths agenda, which is to make ourselves whole and to use those tools and institutions that want to make us whole. Because the founders of this country made a business decision, and the business model included slavery and free and cheap labor. And the slavery was like the wolf, who they could not, they had to keep their hand on the wolf. They couldn't let it go because of all the implications. And we see that throughout the history of the United States. As someone said, you can track the history of the United States, and race has something to do with all the major events in the United States. So this is important for us to remember that on Independence Day, we will consider three-fifths of a human, and the agenda for us now is to become five-fifths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We have to take on the five-fifths agenda.
Five-fifths agenda. That's great. I like that. Yeah, look at wholeness. That's in all aspects.
Right.
Yeah, right. That's awesome. Yeah, cool. Well, it's been really wonderful speaking to you, Mr. Pierre, this morning. It's been really, really fabulous. And I know the rest of the conference and today's plenary panel that you curated is going to be really phenomenal around education and, you know, because that's a human rights issue as well. And, yeah, looking forward to finding out more about sort of what folks are doing throughout the country. I know there's this whole thing around anti-poverty, I don't remember the acronym, sort of looking at the war on poverty, because a lot of our people are still, because we didn't have the economic we don't have an economic legacy because we were making everybody else rich. So black folks still, as a whole, are impoverished.
We are resource challenged. Yes, we are.
Yes, we are. Yeah. Wow. Well, you have a good day, and look forward to staying in touch.
Absolutely. I thank you for allowing me to come and share this time with you, and I look forward to us working together on many more projects down the road.
Yeah, certainly. All right, you take good care.
All right, you take care. Great.
All right, peace and blessings.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So we are going to shift a little bit. We're going to play Ben Vereen's Defying Gravity, because I think looking at the five-fifths agenda, we're definitely going to have to defy gravity, you know, that pull that keeps us in one way grounded, but another way could hold us down.
Wicked. I went into the show with Shoshana Bean, and each night I'd hear Shoshana sing this song. I'd like to do it for you now. Something has changed within me. Something is not the same. I'm through with playing by the rules of someone else's game. Too late for second guessing. Too late to go back to sleep. It's time I trust my instincts, close my eyes, and leave. It's time to try defying gravity. I think I'll try defying gravity, and you can't hold me down. Through accepting limits because someone said they're so. Some things I can never change, but till I try, I'll never know. So tired of being afraid of losing love I thought I had lost. Well, if that's love, it comes at much too high a cost. I'd rather buy defying gravity. Defying gravity, and you can't hold me down. Unlimited, my future is unlimited. And I've just had a vision, almost like a prophecy. Oh, I know this may sound crazy, and it's true. The vision is hazy, but I swear, someday I'll be up in the sky, defying gravity. Yes, I can fly, I'll defy gravity, and you can't hold me down, you can't hold me down. A chance to fly. And if I'm flying solo, at least I'm flying free. To those who try to ground me, take a message back from me and tell them I'm defying gravity. Come take my hand, we can defy gravity.
Had an interview with two women and a director who, I guess, exemplify how they did not let the legal system, which did not do justice by their case, bring them down. And I'm speaking of the case of the Newark Four. And I think it's in the work for. there were more women, but these are the women that plead not guilty. And there's a film directed by Blair Doris Walther, Out in the Night, which is screening for its second time as a part of Frameline 38, Thursday, June 26th at 9:30 at the Elmwood in Berkeley, or Oakland. It's on the border. And then Saturday, June 28th at 1:30 at the Castro Theater. And let me tell you a little bit about the film. I'm going to read the synopsis. In 2006, the lives of seven African-American lesbians were ruined after they were branded by tabloid newspapers as a gang of killer lesbians and subjected to prolonged entanglement with the criminal justice system, all arising from one questionable street altercation. The riveting documentary Out in the Night explores the notorious case of the New Jersey Four, named for the four of these seven women who plead not guilty to attacking a male admirer, as in quotations, who threatened to screw them straight, another quote, after they rebuffed his advances. Following the women's lives over many years, the film takes the viewer on a dramatic and heartrending journey as they seek exoneration and justice. Out in the Night introduces us to the women's tough but largely tolerant communities and families on the streets and stoops of Newark, a tolerance they thought they would find when they ventured out that night to New York's West Village, historically a queer safe haven. What transpired is shown through interviews with the accused, their families, journalists, and social justice activists, police testimony, security footage that captured the assault, and readings from court transcripts. Despite no prior criminal records and a demonstrable case of self-defense, and it was, it was a hate crime. The women were sensationalized in the media as violent lesbian gang members on a rampage. An all-white jury was impaneled to pass judgment. While focusing on the case, the film intelligently explores the larger ramifications of the court's rulings and the ongoing media treatment. The individual personalities of the accused women take center stage, but their stories reveal a system steeped in misogyny, homophobia, and racism that marginalizes and fails all of us. And it reminded me also of the case of the young men in New York who were accused of raping and the jogger in the Central Park Five, and none of those men. They were young, too. These women were really young at the time. None of those men were actually imprisoned, and they were found innocent later on. And so in this interview that I pre-recorded, I interview Patrice and Renata, Patrice Johnson and Renata Hill, along with the director of Out in the Night, about the case, about the film. And the director is actually going to be in the theater on Thursday and Saturday, as well as Patrice and Terrain, another one of the women who was arrested and also imprisoned with the others. Yeah, it's just really horrific cases like this, and it's really wonderful that Blair was able to, you know, got, you know, sort of involved with the case and this case and wanted to do something about it, and so she's, you know, got involved right away, and so this particular film and the case is something that she really knows intimately through her own activism. So, yes, really, really great work, and I highly recommend that everyone, you know, attend one of the two screenings, the Thursday, June 26th at 9:30 at the Elmwood, or the Saturday, June 28th at 1:30 at the Castro Theater. So here is the interview. All righty. I just wanted to thank you so much, Blair, for making this document so that, you know, this case is, doesn't just sort of disappear into the night, you know, sort of borrowing from the title, Out in the Night. And I want to thank you, Renata and Patrice, for, gosh, for being willing to share the story with everyone and be on the air speaking with me. And hopefully, are you coming to San Francisco for the screening at Frameline?
I'll be there. Oh, excellent. Yeah, I won't be able to make it, unfortunately. Yeah, Patrice and Terrain and Terrain's mother Tina are going to be at the Frameline screening. Oh, excellent, excellent, super. So should I read the synopsis,
the short one for our audience so they'll know what it's about and then we can start talking?
Sure, whatever works best for you.
Okay.
Or, I mean, I can also tell you what it's about if that would be...
Oh, yeah, that's totally fine. That's even better. Yeah.
Okay. So the documentary Out in the Night is about four African-American lesbians who were attacked in the West Village in 2006 in New York City. They defended themselves and were consequently charged and convicted with varying degrees of gang assault, and attempted murder. They all pled not guilty and ended up receiving 3.5, 5, 8, and 11 years in prison. Well, we can talk more about how I got involved, but part of the reason I got involved was the initial media coverage, calling them a wolf pack and a gang of killer lesbians and attacking her killer lesbians. So that is the story in a nutshell.
Renata and Patrice, I was wondering, do you want to add anything to that, to the synopsis about what happened? Because you all were really young, you know, when this happened. And when I was watching the film, I just was thinking about the Scottsboro boys, and that was like a long time ago, you know, those boys being picked up on the freight train and you know, put in prison and their lives, you know, just really ruined. And then I thought about the Central Park Five more recently, and those, I think, was five young men who were arrested, you know, and charged with the, was it the murder or the rape and murder of a jogger. And to date, the New York has not admitted that they were wrongfully tried and convicted. And then here you all are. Like, oh my goodness, what is this?
Well, I'm just really, it was a traumatizing experience or whatever, wishing that we didn't have to go through that. However, I'm glad that we had the opportunity to turn it around into a positive thing and to be able to have something to fight for instead of allowing it to break us down.
Right.
You know, because we could have just, you know, got arrested, did the time, and came home and allowed it to, like, overcome us, and we didn't do that. So, I mean, be standing for something, and I think that's the most important thing.
Right, yeah. Was that you, Renata? Yeah, and you're a mother, and so what I really like, Blair, can you pronounce that last name, your last name for us? Is it Doris Walther? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, and unfortunately, I don't have, Renata, I don't have your last name in front of me or yours, Patrice. What's your last name, Renata?
Renata Hill.
Okay. Yeah, and Patrice? What's your last name? I'm having trouble hearing you.
Sorry, her name is last name is Johnson.
Oh, thank you. Okay, yeah, Renata, you're a mother, and so one thing that I really appreciate about the film is a lot of times people don't think about the impact of prison on the families, because when a person is incarcerated, the whole family is incarcerated, and you have that sweet son, and I just love all of the scenes, you know, where he shares what he's feeling. And then, Patrice, I just love the scenes with your big brother. They're just so, so wonderful, and your sister, and how when you're in prison, you know, because a lot of times people go to prison and they're forgotten. But, you know, your families, you know, come together and, you know, and support you. And so I was wondering, Blair, if you could talk about sort of how you came to know the story and sort of some of the things you wanted to do with the film and some of the things you didn't want to do with the film. And then Renata and Patrice, I was wondering if you could talk about sort of the impact of imprisonment on your families and how you've been recovering from that since your release.
So I got involved, so really the day after the fight occurred, there was a lot of media attention. It was all really outrageous. And there was one article in particular that really struck me, and it was a New York Times article titled "Man is Stabbed After Admiring a Stranger," and that one stuck out more than the rest, even though it was maybe a little less sensational, but because it wasn't a tabloid paper and it was the New York Times and it's national, and I just didn't think there was any way that a journalist would have called this man an admirer to, you know, a stranger on the street, a young woman at 2 o'clock in the morning, had they been white. So immediately, within a few days of the fight, there was some activist kind of movements around this case, initially just trying to figure out what happened, because, you know, we had no idea. It just felt like the media attention was so long. And so I kind of got involved as an activist and kind of stayed on again and off again as activist throughout the first year and a half to 2 years. And then when they had their appeals coming up in 2008, I realized that I was just so very outraged and passionate about it, and I really couldn't get this case out of my mind, because I just really did feel like it was self-defense, and I had to get railroaded in the media and in the court. So I wrote letters to them and went to prison to meet with them, and then met with their family members and their lawyers, and just started, you know, talking to them about the idea of doing a documentary and if they'd be interested. And pretty much everybody was interested right away and said yes, do it, because so much of the attention had been negative. But you know, documentaries are very invasive, long processes, and I wanted to make sure we all felt comfortable with each other, and because if they weren't so comfortable with me, then it wasn't going to be a good film. So we started just getting to know each other, and then things started the film, and it's 7 years later. So I will let them talk about their experiences and aspirations.
This is Renata. Mm-hmm. My experience with incarceration was, it was difficult. It was hard. It was hard for me because, like you said, I'm a parent, so I had a child that was just behind that had to go through this also with me. And I don't know, at the beginning it was harder than towards the end. I guess at some point you get used to it, you know that you're there, you don't want to be there, but you learn to cope and deal with it. And we had a lot of support on the outside, a lot of people advocating for us and supporting us, writing us letters, sending us packages or whatever. That made it a little bit easier. I didn't get to see my son as often as I would like, and even if I could have, I probably would not really wanted it that much, because every time it came to the time where they say goodbye, it made it really, really hard. So, and then now, even so, it's like we still trying to pick up the pieces and everything. You never really get your life back, you have a felony on your record and it just follows you, and it's like you're getting convicted over and over and over again. At the beginning of my stay, I was hallucinating about seeing my son there. I had seizures, you don't really get the proper medical attention. And I went through mental health. I was diagnosed with PTSD, bipolar, explosive disorder. And medicated. That's the first thing they do with everybody when you're up there. But I'm good. I'm good now. I'm trying to be good. As far as, being back into society and just trying to pick up all the pieces and get my life together.
Yeah.
So I'll, you know, I'll let Patrice talk a little bit more about her experience.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions before Patrice shares. In the film, you say, you share with us how you lost custody of your son while you were inside, and I don't know how much we can tell of the story, so you can share, if you like, what I'm not, you know, including. So I was wondering, like, I don't know, I don't want to mess up the story for people who don't know everything. But, yeah, and so I was wondering, how did you get custody of your son back, and how old is he now? And did you, were you able to be able to find housing, permanent housing?
Okay, so when I came home, it was two different processes. When I came home the first time on bail, after my mom passed away,
mm-hmm.
I went to go see my son, and I was told that I couldn't see him. I wasn't allowed to see him. There was an order of protection because of some false allegations that his caretaker had, threw out there. So it was a long procedure I had to go through while being home on bail to actually get to see him. I did get to the point where I was able to see him on the weekends. And I was convinced that I was going to end up getting time served because I was, you know, working on my appeal. I had one of my appeal at that time. So I started to pick up the pieces at that point, and then I was told that I should either go back to trial or to plead guilty. And at that point, I had already lost so much in my life as far as, you know, losing custody of my son and seeing how he was affected by it. You know, he was really unhappy. And then losing my mom and not really having anybody on the outside, I just figured I wasn't ready to fight again and go back to trial. So I just took the plea that they offered me, which is 3.5 years and 5 years probation and then parole. So I had to go back in, I believe it was like for 11 more months. So that was the hard part because I had to explain to my son after coming back into his life that I had to go back and do more time. But I told him when I came back, you know, afterwards that I was coming straight to get him. So he went back with his caretaker, then I went back upstate. And when I finally did come home, they wouldn't allow me to come back to Jersey where I was originally from. So I had to stay in the state of New York, which I didn't know anybody out here, no family out here. So I went to a program housing program for moms coming home from prison, you know, to help you reunite with your kids. It took me about 9 months to regain custody of them, and throughout that 9 months, I was constantly going back and forth from New York to New Jersey to visit him on the weekends, you know, so that way I can properly transition him from where he was at to where I was. And now I got custody back of him. Now he's about to be 13 years old. He's in sixth grade. And, you know, he knows about the documentary and everything. He thinks I'm a secret guy.
Oh, nice. Yeah, because I really like the animation in the film. It's just a really beautifully shot film, Blair. It's gorgeous. The story is really sad, but there are, you know, moments of humor, and there's a lot of love in the film for you all, your families and community support, and you had appellate counsel, Alexis, right?
Yes, Alexis.
Yeah, yeah. And he was talking about how the judge gave confusing instructions, and that's why you got so much time. And I think everyone probably got too much time. And I was wondering if maybe you could talk about that. I haven't forgotten you, Patrice. And then, Blair, if you could jump in and talk about the animation and that beautiful analogy that you illustrated, you know, with the animation.
A lot of different things we're trying to figure out how to tell the story of the judge, because he was kind of a character in his own right. And I met with him. He gave me maybe like an hour and a half interview, but he wouldn't go on camera. So over the course of the years, I, you know, was poring over the transcripts and read of the trial court, and read them many, many times, and was just trying to figure out how we could tell the story of this judge who doesn't want to be on camera. And one of his things is he just talks and talks and talks. So his description to the jury about what gang assault is and what self-defense entails it was so many pages. It just went on. So what we ended up doing is after I spoke with Alexis and Patrice's appellate attorney, Karen, and then two of Renata's trial attorneys, we just kept coming back to this orchestra analogy that the judge made, and his punctuation of this orchestra analogy was a pregnant woman, which just made no sense, and it came out of left field. So we just took the last chunk of how he was describing gang assault, and it just, what Alexi says is that it just confused the heck out of the jury, and nobody knew what he was talking about. And then when he punctuated it with saying you're either pregnant or you're not, you're either involved or you're not, they just basically thought if you were there that night, you were guilty. And that's kind of how it sums up in the simplest form. So we were trying to just show how, when we decided to do the animation, we were trying to just show how confusing and totally unrelated to the story what he was telling the jury was. And then the one other piece of animation that we had thought about pretty early on was when Kima Train's mother talks about the courtroom being stacked with correction officers before they got their guilty verdict. And, you know, she describes the scene in which, that you would have thought that they were all gangsters or something, and that at one point she couldn't even see her daughter Terrain because there were so many correction officers in the way. And it just, that image, when she talked about that, always haunted me. Because, ultimately I interviewed her about this years after Terrain had been incarcerated, but it was that moment when she just couldn't even see her daughter that she knew her life was about to change. And so that was another point in the story when we were talking about animation, because I thought a really ghostly and haunting image to try to, recreate what she must have been feeling, or to visualize what she was feeling. So that's how we came up with that. I'm not sure if you guys want to talk a little bit about your feelings with the judge. I know that you had, when the judge sentenced you, and talked about that.
Yeah, I feel like, as far as, when it came down to the point where you sentenced us very harshly, you didn't take a lot of, things into consideration as far as our background, the things that we have gone through and the experiences we had gone through that may have played any factor in the way we responded that night and defended ourselves or the way that we defended one another.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like he just didn't care. Nobody, out of all the articles that was printed about us and all the headlines, not once did anybody mention how, I was a single parent, how I worked prior to that, how we never had any criminal background. I just was a group of kids who finished school or was attending school. There was no type of positive information in there at all to even give them something to go off of. So automatically, we, a young group of, friends, black lesbians, we're coming from what they would say the urban area and come out into the village. At one point, we was even asked the question, well, what were you guys doing out here? And this type thing, we coming out here to hang out. And somebody asked us, well, how could you afford to come out here? We didn't have any money. How could you afford to be out here? And we're kind of thrown off by that. You don't need any money to come to the village. This is day central right here. We just came, to enjoy the scenery, looking at stores and things of that nature. So, we already knew we kind of being biased against, but it was really nothing that we could do because nobody was hearing us.
Mhm. Yeah, and then you speak about how you had suffered trauma from when you were really young, and how this this violent attack sort of triggered that as well. From a place you hadn't even been aware, because childhood memories have a way of getting buried in our consciousness, subconsciousness. And then Patrice, you you know, you share quite a bit of your story with the police and, you know, the tragic death of your brother. The police shot him and killed him. That's really horrible. And why don't you tell us sort of about the question that I asked you a long time ago about, you know, after serving, you know, the lengthiest sentence of 7.5 years, I believe. Yeah, yeah, you were the last person to be released. And how do you move forward from that? You were talking about some things on screen. I was wondering, how do you move forward from that, and sort of how do you, I mean, you can't get back those years, you can't get back, you know, seeing your brother, you know, who you really cared about, you know, you missing, you know, being able to say goodbye. So why don't you talk about sort of life after. And how do you heal and forgive after an experience like this?
Basically, I could do one day at a time. I have a really, really, really good support system. Blair is awesome. Lamar is awesome. Denise, Lorraine, Mama Kima, my sister, everybody is still supporting me. I struggle every day with general being out here and how the system is basically set up for, like, at the prison, is a set up for failure, even though they make you prepare yourself to come out here and be successful, where in reality it's really difficult to do so. So I just, like, try my best to stay humble. The thing about prison that most people probably wouldn't know unless they had a family member that, was incarcerated or they was incarcerated themselves, is that prison is a word within itself, and you have a choice to let it make you or break you, and it can turn you into something that you probably really don't like. And you don't notice that the changes that you're making, like, within yourself. You sometimes can become bitter, you can become broken, you sometimes give up on yourself, which leads to, like, self-destruction. And at times I really just wanted to give up. Like, I felt like, you know, well, the system gave up on me, you know, like, how am I going to survive in here, knowing that 50 years from now when I'm going to go home, I was 19 years old when I got incarcerated. So it was really hard on the inside to, like, deal with everyday life, knowing that, you know, it'll be a while before I go home. I coped with it, but it did bring upon, like, a lot of anger issues that I'm dealing with now, and I'll be truthful with myself that I will get the help that I need to deal with that. Like, being there did make me better a little bit. It did anger me the way the system treated us, like, very unfairly. And it's like, how can we ever trust the system again if we ever in any type of situation? It don't gotta be a violent situation. It could be any situation. And just knowing that some officers don't report to certain things because of the area is very, like, messed up. Like, they came so fast to the village, but they won't come so fast to Brooklyn. And that actually happened recently where officers took, I think they responded, like, for an hour. It took them an hour to respond. Hmm. And being home now for me and my family has been hurtful, knowing that I'll never get the chance to be my brother again. It's a reality for me, knowing that, you know, my dad is going through a sickness that, you know, he's trying to fight, but, you know, it's all in God's hands. And knowing all that time that was wasted and being so far from my family, it's a struggle. And all I can say is that I'm just taking it one day at a time. My family is taking my life every day just because of what happened that night. And I see how all of this affected my family. And it really just hurt deeply that we all had to go through that and that all our families had to suffer watching us go through that. And I think that was the hardest part, that they couldn't do anything and, like, get us lawyers and fight for us, but it was like, dang, that didn't even work. And for our mothers, I think it hurt them the most, that they couldn't do anything for us. So now I just try my best every day, you know, don't stay out after dark, watch my back, you know, get to be home at a certain time, and knowing that my family is worried about me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I didn't catch what you said when you said how old you were when you went in. How old were you?
I was 19.
19, yeah. And so, you...
19,
actually. Hmm? Pardon me?
I just turned 19.
Just turned 19. So when you got out, you were almost 30. Wow. All your 20s. Yeah. Wow. I was wondering, Blair, how you had such access. I mean, you actually did interviews behind bars. Like, how did you get that access? I thought it was hard to take a camera into a prison.
Yes, it was. Blue eyes. Blue eyes got her access. excuse me. The interviews at LDN took a year to get. We actually, it might take longer. I started trying to get access at Rikers, and we were granted access the week after the last person was taken out of Rikers. So I really thought we were never going to get access after that. And then, yeah, it took about a year to get into Albion. And they would only let us do an interview in the visiting section. We couldn't go anywhere else in the prison. And they wouldn't let Patrice and Renata do the interview together. I will just say one thing I didn't know during the interviews, and Patrice told me after hers, is that it was in the middle of February, and Albion is near Canada, and so it was freezing, and they would not let her wear any thermals or anything. She went on this, like, super thin shirt, and just felt so bad. She didn't know during the interview, so they kind of, like, rushed them in, mm-hmm. and then they let her stay a little bit afterwards. But, yeah, so that one took a long time, and I think the guards watching us were making some noise throughout the interview just to mess with it a bit. And then the rest of the stuff, the shadows of the prisons and the exteriors, we got permission for trains to release, and then everything else we just kind of shot without asking for permission because it just took too long, and sometimes we got in trouble, sometimes we didn't.
Wow. Yeah, it's just amazing the way you unveiled in the film the dispatch recordings that were not admissible that showed how, you know, the wound that Patrice inflicted on the perpetrator, you know, the man who accosted them, was like a scratch, and that the big incision was surgery that he needed for a hernia, right, or something like that?
The surgery was an exploratory surgery, so he was in the hospital a day or two, I don't remember which, I don't remember exactly which one, with the initial wound, and I guess he was experiencing some pain, and so they did an exploratory surgery. So he did have his stomach and liver nicked, and the liver, they didn't have to do anything about, and the stomach was, his stomach was sutured, and they found a hernia, so... The incision was an exploratory incision based on the wound, but one thing that I thought was really important to show in the film is that when they showed that image in the courtroom, they very much made it sound like that giant incision was Patrice's doing, and that's obviously an incredible injury, and there's no room for discussion on what his actual wounds were, or the fact that his medical records did say that it wasn't life-threatening.
Yeah, there are a lot of instances of that type of, using that kind of, that type of evidence, or showing pictures and not explaining everything, and then having, you know, you focus a lot on the coverage of the trial and the case and the condemning language that starts out right away. You know, the four women are guilty, and I really like that you included a reading of the transcript of the person who was injured. What is his name? Dwayne Buckle. Yeah. And you interview everyone. I mean, the attorneys and the police officer, the one who responded, and I mean, it's just really great having that. And also one of the journalists who wrote something, and she was like still didn't want to say, well, maybe I was a little harsh in that language. I mean, she just would not recant.
Yeah, that was an interesting interview. Much of her interview, she actually was pretty empathetic to the sentences the women received,
mm-hmm.
but she would not analyze her coverage of the upfront at all. It was very interesting. I didn't expect how that interview went.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Terrain and her mother, Terrain was released first, and they came to San Francisco, and they, you know, Terrain spoke at the Dyke March, and then she was on a panel, I believe, with Angela Davis and some other folks. I want you to talk about that visit here, and it's really cool because the film is, you know, screening almost like on an anniversary of that. I mean, here we are in June again.
Yeah, I'm very excited that Terrain and Seema, her mother, are going to be able to make it out to that screening, because I think our second screening in San Francisco is right before Dyke March, I believe.
Oh.
So it really is like an anniversary of the last time they were out here, and mm-hmm. now they're coming out and everyone's out of prison. So, we are really excited about that one. Also because there was a lot of support from folks in San Francisco that supported these women throughout their incarceration. So we're really, really looking forward to that screening. And then we also actually, our New York premiere is next week, and it's going to be at the IFC Movie Theater where it occurred. And, you know, it was their theater that had the surveillance cameras that captured much of the fight. So I feel like the screening in New York is going to be this, you know, reclaiming of space, and then I feel like San Francisco is going to be kind of a celebration of that reclaiming in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're really looking forward to that.
Oh, that's excellent. That's really excellent. Do I have any other questions? maybe you could talk a bit about the other people that were involved in the making of the film, like your cinematographer, and the music is really phenomenal. That Toshi Reagan, I think, was the director of music or something like that, or did she just write the score?
Sure. So, let me start with the director of photography, Daniel Patterson. He actually came on the film, I think, the second day of shooting. So he's been on the film with me for the last 7 years. And really phenomenal, and I've loved working with him, but he is also kind of blowing up right now. He just recently shot Spike Lee's newest film, which is premiering in New York next weekend, and he has two other documentaries that are premiering this week and next week as well, so I was very lucky and excited to be working with him, and he worked really, really well with the women, so we talked a lot about the look of the film together over the course of the years. So I think it looks the way it does because of him. and then Toshi, yeah, so we did an interview with women, I think, back in 2009 in the Albion prison, and got some of Patrice's poetry that she had mailed to me. And I had her read a few of the poems in prison that I thought were just really incredible. She's a quite prolific writer. And pretty early on, I felt like I wanted Toshi to create a song out of one of Chase's poems. So we started working with Toshi, I think proper in October of last year. And she did... We licensed two of her songs, and then she wrote a song that is in the incarceration scene, and then she turned Patrice's poem, Bedford, you know, bedtime story, into a song at the very end of the film. So I think that worked out really beautifully, and I loved hearing it in Patrice's words and Patrice's song. So that was really exciting. I'm very excited about how that turns out, and also I'll let Patrice talk about her experience working with Toshi as well. But the couple other people I wanted to mention about the crew, the animation, since you had mentioned it, we worked with the animators, they're called Apparat, and they're in Sweden,
and they did the documentary Searching for Sugar Man. They did the animation for it.
Oh, wow.
I was really taken by it. So we approached them and started working with them. So that was an amazing experience. And then my producers, who I will quickly name, Yoruba Richin had a documentary premiere at the LA Film Festival last year, and it was at Frameline called The New Black. So she came on the film maybe 5 years ago, maybe even more, maybe six. And then Giovanna Chesler, who is my partner, and she came on as a producer last year, who has a feature that 3 years ago. Oh, I'm sorry. 3 years ago. She has a documentary called Period, The End of Menstruation, and we're going to be working on our next few films together. And then Mirdu Chandra came on last year, and she has done a number of films, including the film about Tired Rustin.
Oh.
Theater Outsider. Yeah. So that's
Oh, really?
Crew.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. We had an excellent crew. Oh, and then I should mention our editors, Kristen Huntley, who did Pray the Devil Back to Hell.
Really?
And
yeah,
Sarah
nice.
Kirsten, who did All of Me.
Mm.
All right, but I'm going to let Patrice talk about her experience in the studio with Hoshi, because I think it was pretty special.
Yeah, wow. Patrice, I didn't know that those were your words, because that was something as I was jotting down notes, I'm like, oh, this song is so beautiful, and I was just trying to, like, jot down some of the lyrics so I could mention them, and those are your beautiful words. Wow.
Thank you. That experience with Hoshi was amazing. I've never been in a studio before. I never imagined any of my poems going public like this. And being brought out, poetry is always like a hobby, something to do, leave to express myself when I'm feeling upset or I don't know no other outlet. I actually started writing when my brother Dana passed away at the age of 12. I started writing. I felt like I ain't had nobody to talk to. So same thing goes with this situation. And being in the studio with poetry, she's wonderful. Like her work is awesome. I was nervous, but she was like, girl, you got this. You'll be all right. Come on, do it, do it. And she made me very comfortable the whole time. Even if the many people was in front of me, because I was so shy. I'm like, oh, my God, this is really happening. And, you know, she coached me through it. And what she did with it was amazing. Like, when I finally heard it, when it was finished, hello?
Uh-huh.
Hello? Oh, I just heard something.
Oh.
Okay. The finishing product was just like, oh, my God, I did that. I wrote those words, and she's really singing it. I couldn't believe it. It was just awesome. And I'm kind of happy Blair did it in her little Blair way of putting my poem in the documentary. I think it was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So is a soundtrack going to be available, Blair?
Mm. That's a good question. We thought about that at one point, and we just haven't been able to circle back to that yet, because we literally just finished the film a couple weeks ago.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So maybe we'll have to think about that next.
Yeah, because I was thinking, Out in the Night is the two screenings at Frameline are Thursday, June 26th at 9:30 at the Elmwood in Berkeley. And Saturday, June 28th at 1:30 at the Castro, great venue in San Francisco. And I was just thinking, perhaps, Patrice, in lieu of a soundtrack, you could bring a chapbook, and we could buy your poems that are in, you know, a part of the score. Because you have
time.
Yeah, because you have time. Because, you know, it's early June, and you have, like, 2 weeks, right? Think about it. I'm sure you would sell out on your first run.
That'd be that would be kind of different and cool. I don't know. I'm kind of teasing that you even brought that up like that.
yeah, you totally just think about it. That would be really nice to be able to, like, have that language, something tangible like that to be able to take away. So are you all, what do you want people to take away from the film, and are you involved in any type of organizing presently that people can, look at as a way of, this was self-defense, and you served all of that time. I mean, you had no prior convictions, and you were, upstanding citizens, and this man attacks you, and you go to prison, like all four of you, and the public convicts you before the judge and the jury do. So it's like, yeah.
Basically, like, I agree to this documentary just for the simple fact so everybody can be aware of really what happened.
Because
I was learning as we was going through the whole process, too, and everybody, all the supporters writing us and letting us know, this is wrong. Y'all guys got too much time. And even when we went back, like, a lot of officers were telling us, like, y'all got too much time. Y'all shouldn't even be here. This shouldn't even went down the way it went down. Like, this is so wrong. But what I've realized sitting in that courtroom is that them jurors was not educated on the law, and neither were we, and I felt like they really took that to their advantage and they drove it home. The DA, the judge, the officers, once they known that we didn't know what was going on, I felt like they really took advantage of that, like, oh, these guys don't know, so when they asked us to write a statement, they're like, oh, go ahead, write a statement, you could go home after you write a statement, and none of us was together, like, they separated us. And when we got back together, I'm like, did they tell y'all we was going home? And everybody like, yeah, they asked us to write a statement. They said we was going home. And then we never, ever went back home until after we was released from prison. And I feel like what everybody should say from this is, like, if you're not educated on the law, get educated, because that's the only way you're going to be able to really protect yourself from the miscarriage of, like, the law, period.
Renata, comments on what you want people to take away from the film, and also if you are part of any organizations that you want to, let people know so they might want to get on board. Because one thing about defeating an injustice is, organizing around it, and that's what you did, Blair. You're using your art to change something versus, telling us the story, but it's not just a story. I mean, you show us cases like, the New Jersey 4 is not an isolated case. It's still happening.
Right.
And people are walking. White men are killing black women, killing black children, and walking. Right. Like, really? Standing your ground? And you walk, you kill somebody. These women didn't kill anybody. And they had all this, served all this time.
Exactly. I'm not a part of any organizations as of yet. I do have spoken at colleges and different places with Blair, or she sent me somewhere to speak or whatever. I'm always willing to do that so that my voice can be heard, if people can have a better understanding of what happened or transpired that night and what we went through being dragged through the system. But I did recently just enroll in college to study human services, social work, and I think that's just the beginning for me, because, I'm learning about policies, I'm learning about, different things, and that's just, at the end of the day, my heart is just where, that's just where my heart is, with right and wrong, and being able to help people in any situation where I feel like they're just any type of injustice is being done. This case and this documentary is what really opened my eyes up to see what path I wanted to go down. And what I want people, or feel like people will get from this documentary, is one is the system is not really made for us, and that's just the truth. It's just a big setup, and it's a revolving door for many, because a lot of people get trapped. One mistake and you go to prison. That's always on your record, and it makes it so difficult for people that are coming home back into society to put the pieces up, and it just increases the rate of them going back into prison.
Mm-hmm.
So for us to all of us to remain on a positive path and just continue to try to make a difference is to give other people hope that's coming home that you can make a difference and you can turn it around into a positive thing if you choose to. You just have to, you know, keep your faith and keep moving forward, because, like, I run into roadblocks on a daily basis with my life, and I haven't given up thus far, and I don't plan on it. I want them to understand that the support from people on the outside to people on the inside is a great ordeal, and it's the only difference to those that are behind the bars. And just really fight for what you believe in, you know. It's one thing for us to sit at home and turn the news on and see what happened to Trayvon Martin and say, oh, man, that's a shame. You know, that's wrong. That shouldn't have happened. And for us to be angry and then go outside and look at every white person like they're the one that did it is the difference in you going out there and rallying and your voice being heard and, you know, trying to create laws to protect not just other people's kids but your own kids. You know, I have a son. That could be my son any day. You know, so you got to stand for something, you know, and this is, like I said, it's, this is a start for us, you know.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. And Blair?
Yeah, a couple things. So recently we were asked by the Office of High Commissioner on Human Rights and the Free and Equal Campaign to Decriminalize Homosexuality with the UN to be a part of a film series that they're starting. So we are going to have our first screening on Sunday for that, but essentially they are going to bring the film around to 77 countries where their UN sites are and organize screenings with local organizations on the ground who are doing work around LGBT rights. So we're very excited for that.
Mm-hmm.
And then in terms of a takeaway, a generic takeaway for the film, I mean, we have a number of things that we're hoping to roll out in coming months on the website, but one thing that I think is really, really important that we've kind of been touching on is the right to self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's made its way into the news with Stand Your Ground, but I do think that self-defense is much too narrowly defined in the legal system and oftentimes does not protect the people that it should. In this case, you know, through youth of color, but I think that self-defense oftentimes does not work for women, does not work for black women or women of color, does not work for LGBT youth or gender non-conforming folks. So, you know, and I think that the media played a big role in that. I mean, they immediately not just criminalized and likened these women to animals, but they clearly just didn't believe them. And I think that's a part of it is just like, why weren't these women believed? Why weren't they believed to have felt threatened? And why weren't they believed that they were defending themselves? And I think that is a really, really big problem. And we need to continue discussing it because, you know, like we all talk about people are constantly being incarcerated. They're just trying to protect their own bodies. So I think that's a big thing, and I think that journalists also need to recognize how they write about folks, and they need to figure out a way to put their personal biases aside, or you know, figure out how to write about you know, about folks and humanize them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. When I think about, you know, what happened to Venice, Renata, Patrice, and Tareen, by, you know, Dwayne Buckle, he assaulted them. I mean, he pulled out, did he pull out your hair, Renata?
Oh, no. Yeah.
Hmm?
He was actually one of the other. Yeah, one of the three who pled guilty.
Mm-hmm.
He pulled out Christine Dreadlocks, her record holder's scalp.
Yeah,
Beneath there as well.
Mhm. Yeah, that's really horrible. And it sounded just from just reflecting on what happened that evening, that you know, as the women were going back home to Newark after having fun in the village, they were trying to sort of de-escalate a potential volatile situation, like, oh, you want some of my soft drink? You know, I thought that was really cute, Patrice, when you said that. And then he just kept on going on and on and on, and to the point that as he was accosting, you know, the women, bystanders jumped in to help them. And none of that, you know, made it into the, you know, into the court transcripts, or maybe it did, but anyway, it didn't matter. And I was just thinking about the whole thing around hate crimes, and what he did was, should have been categorized as a hate crime. And I was just wondering, I didn't hear that in anything of the film, and I was wondering, why wasn't that considered at all, what Dwayne Buckle did as a hate, that what it was a hate crime?
We in terms of putting that in the film, we tried to figure out a way to talk about that in the film. It was a little difficult because I don't entirely understand why they couldn't counter with a hate crime.
Mm-hmm.
But the, I guess, simplest explanation that I can understand from two of Renata's attorneys, Susan Tippograph and Murray Cohen, was that once somebody's arrested, police aren't going to look at a counter charge. So they said that there was absolutely no way that they could bring it up because they would have just laughed at them. I mean, I don't know. That's what they said. So I didn't know. I was trying to figure out how we could talk about it being a hate crime against something other than sending women. You know, he initially called up Patrice, you know, because she's a woman, and then it got violent because they were gay. But, my limited understanding of it was just that once you're arrested, it's almost impossible for the people arrested to accuse the person who has now been labeled the victim.
Mm-hmm.
It should have been a hate crime.
Okay. Film. Oh,
sorry. For the record, we do not hate guys. You know, we get hit on all the time. Guys tell us we're cute. And I would have said it had some boy clothes. And they still tell me that I'm cute. And I, you know, kindly say thank you. Sometimes I even blush, you know, because at the end of the day, we do understand we're females. We have feminine features. If they're attracted to us, regardless of how we're dressed, then that's normal. It's natural. So, you know, a nice thank you is good. But when it comes at you in a violent type of, you know, threatening way, that makes the only difference, you know, in the response that you get.
Right. Yeah, it's, the film, once again, is just really, really powerful, Out in the Night. And then I think about, there's a day, says Women Take Back the Night, right? It's like a national night out where women are supposed to be able to be safe, because a lot of times we think about the night, like you were saying, Patrice, now you come in, you're inside when it's nighttime because of, you know, this, horrific experience that you suffered, you and your friend suffered, which is wrong, you know, that you have to come in because there are predators outside, you know?
Yeah.
I can't hear you.
But it does suck, so I don't want to go outside. I haven't really been to a good party since I've been home. I don't know. I really just hope that this film it focuses on the LGBTQ, but I even want women overall to know that you don't have to be gay to be violated. It's violated just by being a woman alone. We've been violated for many decades now, and just look at the history, like, women is supposed to, we're supposed to submit. That's how the society has built it on. Like, women are supposed to submit. You're not supposed to turn a man down, or, you know, they really have it, like, you're really supposed to be home, barefoot and pregnant. And today, women's like, no, I'm a boss. I want to own my own business, and I want to do this, and really society don't like that. So women is always going to have a hard time, regardless. And there's a lot of women, I think, present for defending themselves against men. So I feel like a lot of women get more time than men for the same crime because they are women, and some judges feel that you're not even supposed to be out here doing this. You're supposed to be home taking care of your kids, or, you know, not necessarily working, but supposed to have a husband. And most people are judged when they're not married, to have a family. And I think if we were married and straight, sorry, I didn't got no time at all.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I want to thank all of you so much for this really wonderful conversation, and I'm going to try to make it to one of those screenings so I can get one of your books, Patrice. And good luck, Renata, on your academic career. That's really wonderful that you're going to be going into social work. Say it again. What did you say? I didn't hear you.
I got a 3.3 GPA. I want to lie now and say 3.5 because Patricia said she got a 3.4.
Mm.
But I got a 3.3 GPA my first semester, and that's a big accomplishment for me.
Congratulations. Yeah. So, Patricia, you're in school, too?
Yes, I'm in school. I'm finishing up for my liberal arts degree, my associate liberal arts degree. I started while I was incarcerated with Barr College, and now that I'm home, I'm going to Essex County College to finish that degree.
Okay, great. Excellent. Yeah, well, wonderful. Well, looking for you to, you know, bring your book with you when you come, and looking for, you all to come back around again, you know, once you have, you know, maybe you have some other things that you've done, you know, post, you know, your academic career, like, you know, maybe creating some programs and things like that, and maybe getting into some policy work, because I can definitely see you, Patrice, as an attorney, you know, sort of working to change.
Everybody says that. Wow.
Oh, okay, well, interesting. Yeah, this is wonderful. Yeah, Blair, thank you so much for, you know, bringing us all together in this sort of healing moment, taking a tragedy and sort of, you know, sort of not being a victim, but being, you know, sort of realizing one's power in these really, these situations that sort of reflect, you know, our culture, you know, patriarchal and male-dominated, but that doesn't mean that it has to make us, you know, powerless. So
right, and I will just say real quickly that is one thing that really drew me to them, is that they really were a pocket of resistance that night, and then again in the courtroom when they said not guilty, because that is not an easy thing to say not guilty when you're facing so many years in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And then I feel like they've had to also, you know, defend themselves in the media, so I do very much feel admiration to their endlessly sticking up for themselves in this sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I saw not guilty, I was shocked, because usually with all the browbeating and the isolation, you're always, you know, people are separated from the friends that they were with when whatever happened, and you don't know what the other person is saying, and then they question you over and over again for long periods of time, and you all were really young, and you don't have any kind of legal advice, and your parents aren't there, and the loved ones aren't there, and you all. Well, Patrice, you said, I didn't do it. I'm self-defense. I'm not going to plead guilty. And, you know, you did too, Renata. And I was just like, wow. And I just love it in the film, Blair, when you, like, you know, you sort of draw lines through the names as, you know, people, like, sort of fall off. Okay, they pleaded guilty. And you know, have these powerful women that plead not guilty. That was really wonderful that you took a stand for justice, even if just, you know, the judicial system let you down. You didn't let yourselves down.
Yeah.
Right. Well, safe travels, and you know, have some wonderful screenings before we see you. The Human Rights Watch Film Festival screening, is that before you come this way?
Yes, it is.
Okay, great, great. Yeah, perfect film.
Forward to meeting you as well when we get to San Francisco.
Right, okay, cool. Well, y'all take a can again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Well, I apologize for the buzz toward the end. We were on a conference call, but I think it was pretty clear. I think you could hear the four of us and the three women, the director, and the two heroines of the four who stood up for justice, Patrice Johnson and Renata Hill. So don't miss Blair, Patrice, and Doreen when they are in town this week, in a couple of days, tomorrow and Saturday. I want to close the show with a tribute and a salute to the women piece that I played before by Gina Breedlove, Cover Me, for 1 Billion Rising, of which these four women are certainly among the 1 billion, because they certainly rose up.
There's a little girl inside me, and she's crying from the pain of a past she can't remember and a place she cannot name. There's a little girl who struggles, trying hard to understand how her innocence was stolen at the mercy of his hands. It's memory of I'm not alone. There are millions of us healing.
amnesia. Her voice has been stunted by a haunting family secret. A vocal box tucked beneath the stairway in the basement. No mother ever wants her little girl to get robbed that soon. Does there exist a language to describe those dreams that can only be seen through the keyhole of sleep? My terror is not of failure, but of my capacity to feel. Covered.